So again, good morning to council. Good morning. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are in session in the Stearns County Courthouse in St. Cloud, Minnesota. It is June 20th, 2019. We have six matters on our calendar today. Five of those matters are oral, and then one is a non-oral matter. And I see council are seated at the table, so I'm guessing that we are here and ready to begin the first matter on our calendar. Would the marshal call the case, please?
Sharon Fosterbold, respondent, versus Robert Munson, appellant.
All right, and council for appellant, I'll just make a few comments. If you want to go ahead and get yourself situated at council table, please do that. Bring whatever materials you need, adjust the microphone. We're looking forward to our conversation today, and I'm sure you're all aware of the time limits that apply, and so I just suggest two things. For our oral record, if you make sure you identify yourself for the record and the client you represent, and then keep an eye on the timing system so that you know how much time remains.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thanks very much. You can proceed.
Judge Bratbold, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Joel Novak, and I represent Robert Munson, the appellant in this case. This case is really about one thing. Does a person have a right to know before he goes into a hearing what the consequences could be? A petition under Minnesota Statute 518 is a petition brought by an individual. Subdivision 4A, that individual can request relief under Subdivision 7A or relief that goes beyond Subdivision 7A. Here the petitioner only requested Subdivision 7A relief.
It seems to suggest a due process issue that you're raising.
Yes, Your Honor.
When was the first time the district court was made aware that your client was making a due process challenge to the proceeding?
As soon as he was ambushed by the request for firearms to be taken away. There was nothing in the petition. There was nothing in the prior order. He went there for two reasons.
Just to be clear, what were the words that were used to notify the district court that the district court was to address a due process concern? I want to get a sense of how specifically the challenge was made.
It was not real specific, Your Honor, simply because there was no chance to prepare for it. What counsel said was there was no request for restriction of firearms in the petition. That's important because if I'd have seen one there, or he'd seen one there, I would certainly have made a notice to the Attorney General that we were challenging the constitutionality of 518B.
So it seems to be, as I read that in context, if I were the district court judge, I would assume that the argument at that point was, had we been notified, we would have made a substantive challenge to the statute on Heller grounds, not a due process challenge. And it seems to me that the district court might not have been aware that you were making a due process challenge.
I do understand, Your Honor. However, counsel did say we didn't have notice. And since without notice, there was no way to prepare for this.
Doesn't the statute require, under some circumstances, that there be an order for prohibition of possessions of weapons when an OFP is?
It absolutely does, Your Honor.
Did your client know going into this that there was a chance, depending on what the district court found, that that might be a mandatory provision of any resulting OFP?
Well, the elements that it takes to put 7AB into effect were not an issue at the court. The only issue was whether the temporary order that was standing would become permanent or not. So he wasn't aware that he was fighting about anything beyond 7A.
And just so we're clear, what is the statutory hook for that argument? That the only relief the district court would provide is the reestablishment of the existing OFP rather than providing for perhaps further relief based upon the facts that develop in the hearing?
There's no statutory element to that. However, Your Honor, under Civil Rule of Procedure 7.02A, it says every petition has to say, let me find it and read it here exactly so I don't misquote. An application to the court for an order shall set forth the relief and order sought.
So, counsel, I want to follow up on that. I read your argument and that you're relying in part on that section of the statute, as well as the fact that Ms. Fostervold did not check the box that indicated that she was seeking a firearms restriction. But if you read Ms. Fostervold's petition in whole, she specifically declined a hearing on her ex parte OFP request.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the firearms restriction by statute cannot be issued unless there is a hearing, right? And it's actually your client's option to proceed to the hearing.
Well,
of course, is his right. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But, you know, if you read the whole statute in context, this is, it would be easy for Ms. Fostervold to read the petition as, well, this is asking me what I want for my temporary relief without a hearing. And those are the boxes.
But the judge did not rely on the statutory provision. This was clearly an act of discretion, because if she had relied on the statutory provision, it would have been a restriction for 2 years. Ms. Fostervold asked for 6 months to a year, and then she said, I guess a year would be better. Under her discretion, the judge gave her the year she wanted, not the statutory requirement.
And you're now talking about Ms. Fostervold's specific comments about the firearms restriction, but she did ask for a 2-year restriction on the OFP, right?
No, she didn't.
On contact?
Oh, on contact.
On
yes,
contact.
Your Honor.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and I think what we see is the judge exercising the judge's discretion to keep those two things parallel.
Well, if it was a statutory requirement, you either follow the statute or you don't.
So you think the judge didn't follow the statute?
Not at all.
Part of your argument I find hard to understand. You make a comment in your reply brief that you're not challenging the constitutionality of the statute, but that you're challenging whether the judge followed the statute.
Right.
I'm confused by that.
Well, the statute says if you find these elements, then you take the guns away for 2 years. Mm-hmm. She didn't take the gun away from 2 years. Clearly, she did not follow the statute. But when Ms. Fostervold asked, maybe a year would be good, she followed the request. Now, if you're going to follow the statute, either you leave the guns with Mr. Monson or you take them away for 2 years. She clearly did not follow the statute. On her own discretion, she gave the respondent what she wanted.
Okay. I just to put our cards on the table, at least for me, I think your due process argument is a very plausible one. Had it been raised in the district court, I'm not yet convinced, and perhaps you can convince me that the statement made in the district court by your client put the district court on notice, and the respondent on notice, that you were making a procedural due process claim, such that it wouldn't be waived on appeal, because as you know, you can't make an argument for the first time. You make a constitutional argument for the first time on appeal. Disabuse me of my concern.
I understand that, Your Honor. If you take it step by step, Mrs. Monson filed a petition. She did not ask for the relief. The court granted all the relief she wanted on a temporary, possibly to become not permanent, but 2-year basis. Mr. Monson, and in that, no such relief was granted. Mr. Monson requested a hearing, which was his right. He gets there, and in the middle of respondent's testimony, and in fairness to her, she was kind of ambushed like this, just like Mr. Monson was. Her attorney says, does he have firearms? Well, yeah, I
said. We don't know whether she was ambushed, her attorney.
We don't know, but if you look at her questioning, you can tell she had no idea this was coming. He kind of had to talk her into it. And then she said, yeah, it would be good if he lost his weapons for 6 months or a year. It's very difficult for counsel to prepare for something that he doesn't know is coming.
I understand that, but it's not difficult. I mean, granted, I mean, if these things hit you out of the blue, it's hard to recognize all the possible arguments that might exist at the time. But it seems to me that because counsel expressly told the court, you know, I wish we had been put on notice of this, other than mm-hmm. essentially saying we would have made a Heller challenge to it. So clearly the question of a lack of notice was evident. That issue was evident to counsel, but counsel would have had, I suppose, the opportunity at that time to ask for an opportunity to respond in writing, to make a due process argument, to continue the matter for this question on the issue of firearms because he was ambushed. None of that is implausible to me, but it seems as if it feels like we're looking at this for the first time and the district court never had an adequate opportunity to address it.
This could have been handled better by trial counsel. However, the first words were, there is no request for a restriction of firearms in the petition.
But the next statement explains the substance, the basis for that concern.
Yes, when this hits him, that's the first thing that came to his mind. I think this is a Second Amendment violation. I also think it's a Second Amendment violation, but I think notice was raised by that first sentence, and we don't have to get to the Constitution.
Well, notice is raised, but not a due process. I think you're making a constitutional due process argument, which the district court doesn't seem to have addressed either at the hearing or in the order that follows the hearing. Do you agree that the district court didn't address a due process? The
district court didn't address any of this. It was just ignored. I think that the due process, the constitutional due process issue was raised. Even if it wasn't, a 702 or 7.02 issue was raised. And beyond any doubt, the respondent did not give notice under Civil Rules of Procedure 702 of this remedy, and it wasn't in the first court order. There was no notice at all to Mr. Monson.
Hey, could you tell me again why it is petitioner needed to give notice of relief that's mandatory under certain circumstances?
If Ms. Monson or if a respondent had requested a hearing, she wouldn't have had to give notice. This was a hearing. Okay, relief had already been granted.
Right.
This was a hearing. Mr. Monson wanted that relief or some of that relief quashed. One, for embarrassment reasons. Two, because he wanted to go to the senior citizens card games. And bam, all of a sudden, his weapons were taken away. A 410 and a 22 that he uses for duck hunting and squirrel hunting. It was quite a shock.
Bam is a unique context.
Yes.
I'm not sure my question's been answered.
Okay, what was your question again, Your Honor?
My question is, 518.01, the Domestic Abuse Act, in Subdivision 6 says, upon notice and hearing, the court may provide relief as follows and provides 15 different forms of relief. But subdivision in Parent A, Parent G of that subdivision simply says an order granting relief shall prohibit the abusing party from possessing firearms for the length of the order if certain factual findings are made. So I'm having a hard time understanding why a party has to plead a request for a prohibition on firearm possession when the statute mandates it, because it doesn't seem that the petitioner has any choice in the matter.
And that would be absolutely true if respondent had requested the hearing. Here, there was an order in place. Mr. Monson was challenging that order. That was the only issue before the court. The court, with its raw power, so to speak, went out and said, we're going to find more issues. And
why is that the only issue before the court?
Well, it's not the only issue. There's also the Second Amendment issue.
No, why is it the only issue before the district court? The extension of the ex parte order.
Well, when you have an order in place and the person that the order's against challenges that order, he's coming to court to say this order shouldn't be in place. Now, extending that order
open the door to a broader order? I mean, it goes both ways. If the responding party challenges the ex parte order and requests a contested hearing, it's been my understanding that it's de novo, essentially. The district court has to decide whether there's a basis for the order in the first place and what the relief should be. That's the purpose of having a hearing. You seem to be arguing that if there's an ex parte order and a demand for a hearing by the responding party, the district court is then limited to the relief that was initially granted in the ex parte order. Is that your position?
Pretty much, Your Honor. If the respondent had asked that the order be expanded, then we'd have a different case. Then Mr. Monson would have been on notice that anything could happen. Here, he was just challenging the order that was in place.
Does the statute suggest that the only opportunity for the district court to expand the order for protection after the hearing beyond the ex parte order. It depends on whether it is the petitioner or the respondent who makes the request for the hearing.
No, Your Honor, the statute is silent on that.
Why don't we then, if the statute is silent, and after a hearing, the district court, shouldn't we infer the district court has the authority after the hearing?
Here's the problem.
Relieve the statute?
Here's the problem with that, Your Honor. If that's the position of the state of Minnesota, Mr. Monson had an absolute right to request this hearing. And you're telling potential parties that if you request a hearing, you'll be punished further. That seems to turn American law and Minnesota law on its head. Don't go to court or you'll be punished.
How is that? I'm sorry. Had you finished your thought?
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that so if we overlay your constitutional theory onto the statute such that there is an implied notice requirement that if challenged, then the district court has to respond to a due process notice requirement?
I'm not sure I follow your question.
You seem to be saying that parties can be blindsided and that would be an inappropriate application of the statute. But isn't that so only if the due process issue is presented to the district court and the district court ignores the respondent's due process rights? Going back to the lack of a substantive argument to the district court about this issue being in front of it.
I'm still not following the exact question.
I thought what you were arguing essentially is that by allowing the district court to expand beyond the ex parte order, if the respondent is the one who makes the request for the hearing, then there is an inherent due process concern. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, Your Honor. What's being challenged is the order.
You can conclude your statement. And of course, you know you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Unless you want to pursue it further, Judge Ross?
No, I just want to make sure you can.
In this case, Your Honors, Mr. Monson went to court to try and get the TRO either quashed or limited. He walked out of the court having a broader TRO than he went into court for. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I'm going to just pour a few glasses of water here, but counsel for respondent, you can go ahead. You want me to pass? Okay. Great. I will pass. You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jeffrey Kozin. I represent respondent Sharon Fostervold. This is a simple case, Your Honors. Ms. Fostervold requested an order for protection against respondent, identifying physical assault that took place, identifying fear of future physical harm, identifying activity similar to stalking, and that Mr. Monson came to her house several times, let himself in with a key he refused to turn over to the extent that she had to change her locks. After the order of the ex parte hearing, Mr. Monson, or the order for the ex parte OFP, Mr. Monson requested a hearing. 518.01, subdivision 6, which was on the books at the time he requested a hearing, states in part A that if there is a hearing and the judge has a chance to have testimony before her and make factual findings, that if the judge after a hearing orders an OFP, which prevents future harassing, stalking, and threatening behavior, then mandatorily the gun prohibition comes into effect. It is not a remedy, it's a collateral effect of the factual findings made at the hearing. Excuse me. That's what happened here. The district court found that Ms. Fostervold had been assaulted. It found that Ms. Fostervold was in fear, and those factual findings aren't challenged.
When was the first time that Mr. Monson was on notice that his right to possess firearms was in jeopardy?
When Ms. Fostervold first, or when he first became aware that Ms. Fostervold had filed the order for protection. Again, the statute has been on the books for years, which says if a judge makes the following factual findings as a predicate factual matter, then a collateral effect of that is that you can no longer possess firearms for the duration of the OFP.
Well, if we read Mr. Munson's challenge, constitutional challenge, as one as applied to him, that is, the statute cannot be applied to him because of the nature of the allegations against him aren't significant enough to take away his right to possess firearms, even temporarily, then it seems to me that he wouldn't have known that he needed to notify the Attorney General of a potential constitutional challenge until the middle of the hearing, when the question was raised to the petitioner in this case about firearms possession. Do you agree or disagree with that premise?
I disagree with that premise, with all due respect, Your Honor.
Every time a respondent it chooses to challenge an ex parte order through the hearing process, that individual must, even if firearms have never been an issue before, there's never any concern about firearms, that person must what? As a matter of course, notify the Attorney General that a constitutional issue might appear in the case?
If they expect to challenge 518.01 on Second Amendment grounds, they would have to.
As applied. I mean, in this case, Mr. Munson wouldn't have known that his right to possess a firearm was even at play until it was clear that an allegation was going to be made that might result in the temporary restriction of his possession.
Let me, instead of agreeing or disagreeing, let me clarify where I stand.
Disagree,
I think it's the best way to go about that, because I think it's a. So when Ms. Fostervold filed her petition for an order for protection, she laid out, she has a 4-page letter in her petition that explains the conduct that is the basis for her requesting the order. It explains that he put her in fear of future harm. The statute at issue, 518.01, subdivision 6G, says an order for protection that restrains a party from harassing, stalking, or threatening the petitioner, and includes a finding that the abusing party represents a credible threat to the physical safety of the petitioner. If those two things are met, the restraint and the future credible threat, then there's a prohibition on the ownership, the possession, excuse me, of firearms. Once she had filed the petition, which laid out the basis for her order.
That result in a restriction for how long?
For the duration of the order for protection.
And in this case, the order for protection was?
2 years.
And the restriction on firearms was?
Was 1 year.
So it is clear the district court was not applying that provision.
That's correct. Ms. Fostervold specifically asked the district court, I believe at Mr. Monson's request, but I can confirm, to ameliorate the effect of that statute. That said, because the statute is mandatory, to the extent that the district court exercises discretion to ameliorate the effect somewhat towards Mr. Monson, Mr. Monson hasn't suffered a harm, and there is a standing issue here. That issue was not raised in the briefing, but I'd be happy to provide supplemental briefing on that if you'd like. But if Mr. Monson's position is that the application of the statute correctly should have prohibited him from possessing firearms for 2 years rather than one, then he has not, then he has in fact benefited from this and not suffered a harm. Further, because the statute is clear, it's not vague, it's not been challenged on vagueness grounds, that, and Ms. Fostervold unambiguously requested the relief that forms the factual predicate for 518.01. Mr. Monson was clearly on notice that this would be an issue with the district court. As Your Honors were asking my colleague, Mr. Monson failed to challenge it, either as applied or as on its face at the district court. He failed to raise any due process concerns at the district court.
But he does mention the Heller case in his argument.
He does mention the Heller case in his argument. And right. If you'd like to get to the...
You made the argument in your brief that there wasn't sufficient, that the appellant waived a Second Amendment challenge. And I'm just asking you, he does mention Heller. He does mention the Second Amendment. Yes, it was closing argument, but these are summary proceedings in which, during the course of the proceedings, this particular, the firearm restriction became an issue.
So, Your Honor,
is that
waiver, correct.
Or isn't it waiver?
I believe that is waiver.
Because?
Because the reason that the district court is supposed to hear the issue before it comes to the Court of Appeals is that it can be fully briefed and argued so that the relevant facts can be put on the record, and so that the parties have a chance to make the legal argument in the relevant factual context with the district court.
So you think the record is not sufficient for our review factually?
I think to the extent it was not raised in a way that Ms. Fostervold's attorney below could respond to it, and that the judge could benefit from briefing at the district court below, then yes, I believe it was waived for failure to raise it.
Can you give me some details on that? What's missing in the record? I mean, obviously you don't know what the appellate would have presented below, but what would you have done to flesh out that record?
I think Ms. Fostervold could explain, for example, the district court found in its opinion, it's on page 76 of the addendum, that petitioner's knowledge the respondent kept a firearm and ammo in the trunk of his car added to her fear for her future safety. If the respondent had known that this would have been raised as an issue, that fear of future safety, which is in the record but not fleshed out in the record, would have been much more subject to factual fleshing out.
This is in her affidavit you're referring to.
No, I'm referring to the district court's factual findings in the order for protection.
And I'm just sorry, oh, Judge Ross, and the page number that you are referring to, you gave it quickly, so.
It's in addendum page 76. Okay. It's paragraph 4 of the district court's factual findings.
No, neither in the ex parte order or in the affidavit basis for it was there any reference to fear being based on his possession of firearms. Am I correct in that?
That's correct.
You don't see any. So in order for Mr. Munson to have been on notice about his firearm restriction, you're saying it has to be constructive notice or potential firearm restriction. It has to be constructive notice based upon the statute, not any actual notice in the record, either by the district court or by the petitioner.
That's correct. In the same way that it would not violate due process, for example, for someone who is adjudicated guilty of a drug restriction to then collaterally be removable from the country, for example. It's an effect which is encapsulated in federal statute that once the predicate factual findings are made by a court, then the collateral effect applies automatically whether or not it was raised in the court. The person against whom the collateral effect is being applied is given notice by the publication of the law. Judge Bratvold, because you've asked about the Second Amendment issue, I know my colleague didn't raise it, but if you'll permit me, I'd like to...
You mean an oral argument? It's raised in the brief.
Yes. Didn't raise it in oral argument, but I'd like to briefly touch on that issue.
Now, as I read your argument on the Second Amendment issue, you start by contending that this is an individual, Mr. Monson, based on the OFP litigation, who's categorically excluded from Second Amendment rights?
No, Your Honor.
You are not making that.
We're not making the argument that he's categorically excluded.
Go ahead.
The courts from Heller on have held that the Second Amendment applies as a core, the core of the Second Amendment applies to peaceable and law-abiding citizens. And so when Second Amendment restrictions apply to the rights of peaceable and law-abiding citizens, certain courts have held that they are required to satisfy strict scrutiny to be upheld.
Does it matter what kind of law we're talking about? Someone is a chronic illegal parker. Is that a law-abiding citizen? Maybe overdue library fines?
I would suspect that it is a law-abiding citizen, Your Honor.
The nature of the conduct matters.
Yes.
And in this case, we've got a poking of a finger towards someone and I think a grabbing of an arm and some other facts, what is the highest level of criminal assault that would have resulted from this conduct if it were, say, two strangers engaging?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. Pretty low-level assault, possibly.
Do you think that's the kind of non-law-abiding concern that Heller was referring to? Referring to felons.
I think that as a factual matter, the district court found that there was assault, regardless of the letter, stalking, and threats of future harm, and credible fear of future harm, and that every single federal court of appeals to have examined this issue under the parallel federal statute, which prohibits those subject to domestic violence restraining orders from possessing firearms. It's not an issue here because it's limited to only married couples, those who share children, and those who cohabit. And Minnesota's statute applies to those in dating intimate relationships as well. But every single federal court of appeals to have addressed the parallel federal statute has found that there is a compelling interest in reducing domestic violence, and that those who have adjudicated to commit have committed domestic violence satisfy whatever the test is, whether it be intermediate or strict scrutiny.
Regardless of the conduct that supports the finding of domestic assault.
That's correct. Once the conduct rises to the level that the district court can correctly issue an order for protection, it is found that satisfies the requirements.
You think it matters how individual states define domestic assault or domestic abuse as to the constitutional question?
It has not for any federal courts to have addressed the question, Your Honor.
So however broadly Minnesota might decide to define the term domestic abuse or domestic assault, you think that that heading is enough regardless?
I think that that is a question that's not at issue before this court. I think I'm sure there could be instances where a state could come up with some bizarre basis for defining domestic abuse. But to my knowledge, no states have said domestic abuse entails, you know, leaving the coffee cold, something, you know, that's you know, obviously absurd on its face, that state legislatures take their, you know, take their duty to attempt to, you know, to mitigate domestic violence seriously. You know, to the extent that, Your Honor, the Supreme Court of Minnesota in Benendorf v. Commissioner described in upholding certain Minnesota statutes relating to domestic violence that Minnesota, the state, has a compelling interest in protecting individuals who from those who pose a threat of domestic violence. And that's the Supreme Court's most recent statement on the matter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal if you choose to use it.
First, the mandatory nature of the statute, it simply was not used in this case. As respondent admits...
How do we know it wasn't used and the district court didn't simply grant your client a bit of a favor by allowing for less than the full 2-year term?
Because quite frankly, she does not have the authority to do that. You follow the statute. That's it.
If the district court had followed the statute in this case, based upon the findings, how long would the revocation or the restriction?
She would have had to restrict for 2 years. So it shows when she didn't do that, she didn't follow the statute.
Counsel, in looking at the statute, it pretty clearly sets out the circumstances under which there must be a hearing. And then once there is a hearing, describes what should happen as well as this mandatory firearm possession prohibition. Can you cite me to anything in the statute or to any case that suggests that the reason why a hearing was ordered impacts the issues that may be considered at the hearing? Because the way the statute's written, it appears to say once you're having a hearing, everything's in play.
The only way I can respond to that is the petitioner had her chance to request a hearing. If she wanted these remedies, she could have asked for them in the initial petition. She chose not to do that. Mr. Monson sure wasn't petitioning so that more of his rights could be taken away from him. He was petitioning to get some of his rights back. The court's saying, no, we're not going to give any of those rights back to you, is perfectly within the court's discretion. But saying, we're even going to take more rights away from you, punishes him for requesting the hearing that he had a legal right to.
Isn't your challenge then to the statute, not to what the district court did?
Not to the statute at all.
The statute seems to afford the district court discretion to provide remedies based upon whether there's a hearing, not based upon who requests the hearing. I thought you conceded that point.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but if it's like a plaintiff going to court, the defendant not countersuing, and the judge saying, plaintiff, you're not getting nothing, but defendant, I'm giving you $10,000.
But the statute allows that to happen. Once there's a hearing, the statute provides greater remedies. I mean, the statute specifically says if it's an ex parte OFP, the district court can only order certain things. But once there's a hearing, the district court can order more things and must order certain things. So it seems that the occurrence of the hearing opens the door to broader remedies, which in this case harmed your client. And so it doesn't, the way the statute is written, if your client would have said, well, I'll live with the ex parte OFP, he would have been better off than having gone to court and had a hearing. And I don't know, on what basis do we say the statute's wrong for allowing that to happen?
But there's nothing in that statute, Your Honor, that says, even if it's respondent that requests the hearing, more relief can be granted against him.
But there's nothing in the statute that says the scope of relief available or the protections that the court may order are determined based on who requested the hearing or why there was a hearing.
The key word, Your Honor, is nothing. It doesn't say one way or another. So if you apply logic...
The statute says the following relief is available to the district court if there is a hearing. And the plain language of that allows the district court to provide the remedies that are listed if there is a hearing, without restriction as to who. Let me ask it a different way. What specific language of the statute do you believe the district court violated when it afforded a remedy beyond what was requested in the petition?
Nothing in the statute, Your Honor. But I think if you brought every legislator that voted on that in here, none of them would read it that way. They gave both sides a right to a hearing. No party is going to request a hearing to get more relief against themselves.
But you're asking us to read the statute in a way that's inconsistent with the plain language. And we can't do that. This is how, we don't get to what they intended or what they would think of this. If we look at the statute and the language is clear and the way it's written, it allows the district court to expand the relief it orders once there's a hearing and says nothing about, you know,
I understand what you're
saying, being based on who requested the hearing.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I am a textualist, and I would look at the words and say, what do the words mean? There's only one thing that can overcome the plain words, and that is the plain intent. No legislature would pass that. Excuse me, Your Honor?
Only if there's an ambiguity. Maybe I should ask it that way. What is the exact language in the statute that you believe is ambiguous, that isn't subject to a clear interpretation on the face of it?
I can't point to anything right now, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame, and we thank counsel for your presentation here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.